Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have with me once again Dan Oliver. He is the director of the Committee for Monetary Research and Education. That's CMRE for short. It's a twice-a-year dinner that's put on in New York with a lot of excellent speakers, mostly free market-orientated speakers that come and talk there, and Dan heads that up, but he also is very much involved in investing in the in various things, but I think mostly in gold mining shares and gold and the gold sector on behalf of Myrmican Capital. And I think that's probably what occupies most of his time, but he is also, I think, a free market thinker that I really appreciate. I really enjoy reading his missives as they come through, and we want to talk to him today about some of those ideas that he's recently passed along to his investors and to his readers. Thank you very much, Daniel, for coming on with me today.
Well, thanks, Jay. Always appreciate talking to you.
Always fun to talk to you and to hear and to read what you have to say. You know, in a missive that you recently wrote, you noted that the Keynesians, sort of the Keynesian religion, I would call it, these guys have sort of taught, really have sort of come to the conclusion that it doesn't matter how much debt is piled on in the economy, it's not going to hurt us. How have they arrived at that view?
Well, the Keynesians look at the economy from an accounting point of view, and they point out something which is probably correct from an accounting perspective, which is that every debt owed is a credit as expected. So if A owes $1 million to B, then on an aggregate basis, all that means is that one owes the other money. And the way they describe it is that on a societal basis, when A pays that money to B, it's just like changing money from the right hand to the left hand, and therefore it makes no difference. Debt levels make no difference. And of course, the problem with this analysis is that if someone lends money to someone else and expects to get paid back, he runs around and behaves as if that money is there due to him and going to come back. Meanwhile, even if it's been lost, he doesn't know that yet. And the analogy I think that makes sense is the Madoff investors. Right? Madoff, maybe they invested $1 million at Madoff, and they get statements saying that they're worth $10 million. And so they adjust their lives so as to behave as if they're 10 times richer. And then when do they discover that actually the money is all gone? Or I think in Madoff's case, many of them got some of their money back. In other words, they got their $1 million back, but the problem was that they had been spending for the previous 10 years as if they had 10. And the realization that they only ever had the $1 million, they've actually spent their capital, is what causes depressions. People wake up one day and they realize, wait a second, all this debt we were expecting to get back from the people we lent money to isn't really there. You know, as an amusing anecdote, I was at an investor conference at Bloomberg a few weeks ago, and there was a gal there bragging about the fact that her fund had $20 billion of credit to a potential investor. And I said, oh, you mean people owe you $20 billion? You really think they're going to pay you? And the smile sort of vanished from her face, and the investor laughed as if he'd never considered this before. And of course, all credit is the flip side of debt. And so the problem the Keynesians have is that, yes, in an accounting perspective, they're correct, but from a psychological perspective, they're very incorrect. And we see that when societies accumulate too much debt, resources get misallocated. Eventually, people realize that they're not getting paid back, and you get a depression.
Sounds like what you described as a Ponzi scheme, which I guess a lot of people have called the Madoff scandal. Is this a model, though, for the bigger economy? Do you see this as basically what's going on a much larger scale even than Madoff?
Well, of course. And one of the things that I think that people don't understand really very well at all is how markets go up. You know, when markets crash, everyone wants to know, where did the money go? Everyone was selling stocks, and where did the money go, right? And they never ask themselves on the way up, where's the money coming from?
Yeah.
And the answer is that, you know, when you own a stock, you put up cash and you buy the stock, any broker is willing to lend you money against that stock because you have ready collateral. If the market starts going down, they can instantly take the collateral, sell it, and repay the loan. So the bank system is very willing to lend you money against it. And where does that money come from? In a fully reserve system, that money they lend you would have to come from someone else, from someone else's savings. In a fractional reserve system, which is what we have, the money doesn't come from anywhere. The banks literally create that credit money from nothing. And so as the market goes higher and higher, people can borrow more and more money against their stocks. However much they've borrowed, if it goes higher, they get more credit and they can borrow more against that collateral. And so that's why markets tend to go up for long periods of time, because it becomes a self-reinforcing cycle. With the higher they go, the more money there is on the sidelines to power it higher. But of course, the reverse also happens. When markets start going down, margin calls are going out, people have to sell, they pay back the money. The money doesn't go anywhere because it didn't come from anywhere. It is destroyed, and the money on the sidelines disappears. And so, you know, after every crash, society always looks around, they're trying to figure out a scapegoat. Who got all the money? And they discover a couple short sellers got rich, and they say, well, they have it. And of course, there are always short sellers, and they always do make a little bit of money, but it's a fraction, a tiny fraction of the money actually in the market that literally vanishes when you go in reverse. And again, this is another reason why credit cycles are so disruptive, because when you have the banks printing this credit, again, on an accounting basis, it may still be true that all the money borrowed is money owed. But what it does is it goes into stocks. People feel rich. They stop working because they don't need to work because they have so much money. They buy fancy houses they can afford, cars they can afford, all those things. And that can maintain for a certain period of time. But once the illusion melts and it turns out that they didn't have that money actually, and they left the workforce, and now they have less money than they thought they had, and they have to go back to work doing something they don't like. And so those are the disruptive things that debt levels cause that Keynesians don't see. But if you read any amount of economic history, it is very apparent that this is how the system works.
Does it matter, Dan, that the United States is a debtor nation, a major debtor nation? We were a creditor nation up until Nixon, I guess. And so this whole argument that the Keynesians make, if everybody in the United States owed it to everybody in the United States, would that be less problematic than the United States owing so much money to China and Japan and other countries?
Well, you know, that's an excellent point, because usually in business schools, at least the one I went to and talking to other people, that's how the textbooks are written. Yes, it's always presented as an indigenous thing, as this debt is owed amongst ourselves. But as you point out, that much of the debt is actually owed to other people, to the Chinese especially. And the way that usually plays out, of course, is that one day the accounts don't balance and the U.S. can't pay its debts. And then China stops sending us goods. And then what happens is that prices go up. And the situation the United States has with China is actually very similar to the situation that the U.S. had with Europe back in the 20s. In the other direction, as you point out, the U.S. used to be the biggest creditor nation. And the way that worked out was, following World War I, much of Europe's manufacturing capacity had been destroyed. In the U.S. came through unscathed because the war wasn't here. So we had all these factories making all these goods, and the Europeans couldn't afford to buy them because they owed us all this money in the war debts that they borrowed from us. So the business world started sending goods to Europe on credit. So not only did the Europeans on a sovereign basis owe us money for the war debt, but on a private basis, they owed us tremendous amounts of money too from all the goods we were sending them. And the U.S. economy developed to export all these things. We built lots of factories. We developed lots of commodities to do this. And then one day, not in 1929, that was the stock market bubble. In 1931, when the bond market bubble broke, which meant the market realized that the Europeans were never going to pay us what happened for the goods we had already shipped them, it turned out that we had massively overexpended capacity beyond what the economy could sustain. And so for the next 10 years, during the Great Depression, we had to rationalize all of that excess capacity, and we got lots of deflation. Of course, in Europe, they no longer got U.S. goods, and so they had lots of inflation. And I think the same thing's going to happen between U.S. and China, but just playing different roles, where the Chinese now have massive overcapacity to ship us things that we simply can't afford, that we're not paying them for. We're giving them IOUs, and one day the bond market will revolt, and the Chinese will realize that they're not going to get paid for the things that they have already shipped us, and that their economy is very much out of whack.
So do you think that as a debtor nation then, that what will make the Chinese goods and so unaffordable for us here in America will be a dollar that crashes or that goes down substantially in value?
Yeah, I think what happens is that the U.S. dollar, as you know very well, and probably most of your listeners do too, was originally a measure of silver. The Currency Act of 1792 defined the dollar as a certain number of grains of silver. And over time, that definition changed to where now if you ask them what is a dollar, they really don't have any idea, but the dollar actually does have a specific identity, and that is it is a unit of the liability of the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve is a bank. It has assets and liabilities. Its liability is the dollar, and its assets now are very long-term treasury bonds and also mortgage-backed securities. And the way a treasury bond is priced is it's priced off the interest rate. When interest rates go up, bonds lose value, and the longer term a bond is, the more it loses value. So in my view, when rates finally go up, what's going to happen is that the bonds on the Federal Reserve's balance sheet are going to lose value rapidly, which means this liability has to lose value too, and that being the dollar. And so you'll see, contrary to what many on Wall Street think, you'll see nominal interest rates going up at the same time that the dollar is going down. And of course, gold will be going up too because the dollar will be going down. And that will set the stage for other imports and other things that people buy becoming much expensive. And of course, you already see this in a little bit in the food prices that are going up quite substantially. Grain prices have backed off a bit because the weather's been so good. But if you look at the longer term a supply chain of food, which involve the core proteins, beef, chicken, pork, those eggs, those sorts of things, the prices there are roaring ahead, I think at an 8% rate for the past 12 months. And that puts a real squeeze on consumers and is due to dollar weakness that, in my view, is already starting to accelerate and will continue to do so.
So we saw, certainly, I remember the 1970s very clearly. I was a young man during those days, but I remember interest rates were rising along with gold. Gold was rising and started rising very rapidly, even along with nominal interest rates, but real interest rates were falling because the cost of all the things you had to buy were, was going up dramatically. So is that sort of what your scenario, sort of a stagflation type of a scenario?
Yeah, that's exactly right, and you put your finger on it. Again, most Wall Street analysts write that when interest rates go up, gold will go down because gold likes negative interest rates. And so if interest rates are higher, then obviously you expect it to go down. And in the static analysis, of course, is true, but the economy is not a static thing. It's a dynamic system. And if you look back at the data as opposed to wishful thinking, when nominal rates go up, real rates tend to go down. And the reason is just what I've described, that the losses in the purchasing power of the dollar when rates go up because of the Federal Reserve's balance sheet outweigh the extra income you get from the nominal dollars. And that's what creates negative interest rates. And that's why precisely, as you say, if you look back in the 70s, it was during the time of rising interest rates that gold had its best performance. So I think that's what's in front of us. And I would add, Jay, also that nature, the character of the Federal Reserve's balance sheet in the 70s was very different. The Federal Reserve held exclusively government bonds, treasuries, mm-hmm. and the average duration was around 2 years, 2 to 3 years. So they were relatively insensitive to interest rates, and yet rates went from, 6% in 1977 to 21%?
Right.
In that order, and that was when gold ran from $100 to $875. Well, now the average maturity of the Fed's balance sheet isn't 2 or 3 years; it's over 12 years, and so it's that much more sensitive to interest rates and to losses. And that's why I think when rates finally start going up, the dollar is going to have major problems, and I expect that the gold will perform better in this cycle than it did in the 70s because the Fed's balance sheet is that much more impaired.
Well, we have a debt to GDP level now that is far greater than any time in at least since the Civil War. I don't know before then, but I think it was something like the debt to GDP in 1932 or thereabouts was something like 230% of GDP, and now using the government's numbers, it has hit 360% or something like that. It's come off a little bit, perhaps, but it is extremely high. The 1970s doesn't compare with what we have now, and the 1930s didn't even compare. So, Bob Hoy, I think Bob Hoy, is talks about this being the sixth major credit, the sixth major bubble, or let's say debt bubble or credit bubble, however you want to term it, that we've had in history. And his view is that that whenever, you know, that ultimately these bubbles have to burst and you have a deleveraging, whether it's, I guess Bob, it leans on the deflation side of things, but I think that history bears it out that ultimately the debt, the leverage has to come down. I suppose it could come down through inflation. But if interest rates start to rise, nominal or real, but it's even nominal, I would argue that this economy is in a heap of trouble given the huge amount of debt that we have. Would that not then lead to a possible deflation of a lot of different assets, perhaps financial assets, if not the tangibles?
Well, it's all good points you raise. The debt to GDP ratio, I think, was up around 400%, and then the U.S. government defined what GDP was to include more things.
Okay.
And then, of course, as GDP went up, and its debt is the same, the ratio went down. So, yes, now officially it's around 350%, but that doesn't include off-balance sheet liabilities of the government, for example. And I don't think it includes the shadow bank system either. So the real numbers are probably a magnitude of that amount. And so, yes, to your point, when rates go up, very bad things will happen because it means people won't be able to maintain their debts. And this is a critical difference, again, between now and the 70s, as you point out, because in the 70s, that ratio officially was 150%. So when Volcker raised rates from 6% to 21%, there wasn't that much debt in society. 100% is actually, as for a societal basis, not just the government, but everyone in society, mm-hmm. is a very low level. And so the country was able to withstand that shock therapy. Today, if rates went to 21%, there's no possible way people could pay their debts. And so everyone would default. And I do know Bob, and I respect him enormously, and he does lend on the deflationary side of things because he thinks that once the margin calls come out, mm-hmm. as I described earlier, there's nothing the Federal Reserve can do. One default leads to the next, and the Fed can make credit available, but if no one borrows the money, then you can't get a reflation. And I'm not sure I agree with that in the sense that one of my own errors in analyzing the economy was, you look back through history, and normally when you see cascading defaults begin, there is nowhere to stop them, because A defaults to B, and then B doesn't have money, yep. E defaults to C, and so on. But with the Federal Reserve, they really tore up the rule book, and they went out in 2008 and 9 and simply bid up the prices of the critical assets, and they guaranteed all of the institutions from failure. I think Bloomberg calculated the total guarantees were around $18 trillion. I mean, it's mind-boggling numbers. And what they did was it forced the nominal prices of these assets higher, and that disconnected the phone line to Mr. Margin. And that is how the world shifted from this cascading collapse back into a new credit boom, which of course we're in now. And if you look at the, I think the Bank of International Settlements, recently had a report that said that the total credit levels, debt levels, now versus 2007, the peak of the last credit cycle, is 40% higher. So yes, they defeated the cascading default collapse, but at the expense of making a much worse bubble and much more rickety capital structure than we had before. So the question is, what happens in the next crisis? And again, my view is that the Fed's balance sheet and other central banks, their balance sheets are much more impaired than they were last time. And so I question whether when the next crisis happens, and undoubtedly the Fed will offer all sorts of guarantees again, but even without that, will capital run to the dollar as a safe haven? One of the things that Bob says is that in a crisis, in a crash, capital goes to the most liquid item, and I agree with that. And mm-hmm. and for me, the most liquid item is gold. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's where capital is going to go. And what's interesting is if you follow the gold, the markets closely, the broader markets and the gold markets, which I do, the gold and the broader markets are behaving in an anti-correlated fashion, almost tick for tick. If you watch it during the day, when the market has a leap up, gold is under pressure and then vice versa. So I think gold is just kind of hanging out, waiting for the current credit cycle to roll over. It's hard to know when you're on a parabola, just how high it's going to go in a bubble, how high will it go? But I think in terms of time, we must be near the end, and the reasons are that the amount of credit that's been pushed into the system is so high that the Fed is getting nervous, and they're starting to pull it back. That's what tapering is all about. And if you look at what Bernanke did in 2005, he was also nervous about the credit cycle. He pulled back, and that's what precipitated the 2008 crisis. And in fact, the tapering's been going for almost a year now. So we're almost a year into the tightening cycle, because tapering is tightening. And there's I don't think there's any way that this massive hyper credit cycle we're in can continue without the Federal Reserve stoking it. And so when it rolls over, I think that's when we'll see the next larger crisis hit. And I suspect the larger crisis means that the crisis goes beyond national currencies, and that becomes the focus of the crisis, and gold comes into its own as the place to preserve your capital.
We'll have a currency reset of some sort, perhaps.
Oh, I think undoubtedly. And if you read the intelligentsia, they're all talking about these issues, the Council for Relations, the BIS, the IMF. All the academics are all writing about the next stage of currencies beyond the dollar, beyond Bretton Woods, and all those sorts of things. And on some sense, academics write lots of things, and it's not always related to the real world. But policymakers are very influenced by these academics. As you know, big academia and big government and big banks and big business are all connected with each other.
Yeah.
And so the lots of these ideas are perhaps raised now in a context where it sort of seems impossible. It has no application. But then in a crisis, that becomes the blueprint for what they want to do. And you see this very clearly in Bernanke's career. He wrote all those papers about how to deal with inflation, how to deal with crashes, back in the 90s and early 2000s, when that was the last thing in anyone's mind. And yet, there it was. And so he was, quote unquote, the dream team, right? And he was the man. I mean, Time magazine lauded this guy. It was so lucky that this guy was in the right place at the right time in 2008. Well, but they've been preparing for this for years, because they knew about the flaws in the system, and so I think that anyone who has any I think intelligence and perspective on the markets and the currencies knows that things are very, very wrong, and the time to think about what to do in a crisis is before it happens, so that once it happens, these guys, these one world government people, can simply have a fait accompli and impose whatever reforms they've pre-designed.
All right, we're just about out of time. We've got a couple of minutes left, and I have to ask you about gold shares. I know that you like the gold shares. Could you tell our listeners what kind of gold mining companies are you preferring these days?
Sure. I mean, gold mining companies come in lots of different shapes and sizes. I think there are thousands of listed companies. And my analysis of the gold shares in general is that what a gold mine really is a spread trade between industrial commodities, which is the input cost, and gold, which is the output cost. And when you have credit levels rising, gold tends to underperform commodities. So margins get squished, and it's not a happy place to be. As everyone knows, for the last 3 years, that's what's been happening. When credit levels fall, and they tend to fall very quickly, that's when margins really blow out. And so you're playing that spread, and credit levels don't really care about the nominal prices. In other words, credit can disappear in an inflationary basis, or sometimes it disappears in a deflationary basis. But either way, the spread between commodities and gold blows out, and you get added margin. So that's your safest bet. If you want to take more risk, of course, miners that have lots of debt denominated in dollars very much do care about which outcome that is. Because if you have deflation and your margins get higher, but you've got tons of debt, you might not bid anyway. So in those circumstances, you want to look for inflation. And so I think that those companies offer a more of a boost in the inflationary outcome, which is what I expect. And then the last point would be that companies in production don't need to raise capital. They have cash flow. And I think that in a crisis, capital becomes very, very scarce. And so looking at exploration companies, they become very, very hard to raise capital, because the potential cash flows are so far in the future that the discount rates get so high that they can't ever finance it, no matter how much gold they have. So I think when you're investing for a crisis, you want companies that actually have current cash flow or raise the capital to build a mine.
Absolutely. Unfortunately, we're out of time. We've got to get you back to talk more about that topic for sure.